Hello and welcome to our University of Strathclyde podcast series, run out of the world-famous School of Education, right in the heart of the beautiful city of Glasgow in Scotland. We bring you a mix of meeting academic interviews, thought pieces, conversations and provocations on all things education, to give you a glimpse into our world-leading education research here at Strathclyde, and of course to stimulate your questions and thinking around the meaning, purpose and practice of education. In schools, in communities, and of course in all our lives.
Hello and welcome to the School of Education podcast here at the University of Strathclyde. Today I am delighted to be joined by Emeritus Professor Effie McLellan, who is going to share a mini lecture, if you like, on an ambitious topic given the time we have. She's going to talk about shifts in understanding of teaching over the last 50 years. Welcome, Effie. Maybe you'd like to share a wee bit of your own professional background for our listeners.
Thank you very much, Claire. What a lovely welcome. I, first of all, would like to say I'm delighted to be here. I've taught for a long time now, more than 50 years if I do the sums, and I've had a very interesting career. And as Claire says, I want to focus today on one aspect only of education, which is teaching, and I'll explain why I want to do that in a moment or two. I'm interested in teaching because I've been teaching for so long, and because I think teaching, as distinct from learning, which is another topic altogether for me, I think teaching is an extremely important and very, very demanding activity. I've worked for the university for a long time. I think I started to retire in 2009, but then I was kept on because of the research assessment exercise. And then after that, I was made a research professor in the school to mentor and help less experienced members of staff. And then I was finally, I was taken off the payroll finally in 2014, but thereafter retained my interest in teaching and teacher education, because I was doing a lot of peer reviewing of journal articles, and eventually in 2018 became the executive editor, or one of the executive editors, in the big journal Teaching and Teacher Education. So I'm still very involved at a distance, so to speak, in teaching and teacher education as it takes place internationally, which is a lovely background from which to be able to speak today. Now, I wanted to distinguish teaching from learning for three reasons. I wanted to distinguish it from the current waffle, if you like, that we hear about how to teach in the age of this pandemic. I mean, words to the following have been heard by a particular politician who has said, being at school full time is best for pupils because they are with qualified teachers. But if that's not possible, we can revert to blended learning. Now, whatever blended learning is, and I'm not saying that there aren't advantages to blended learning, all I'm saying is that it is not of equivalent meaning to teaching. The second point I would make in defense of teaching being worthy of consideration on its own is, again, educational policymakers and educational institutions have recently been lauding how they have improved their practices in what they call the delivery of teaching and learning, as though it were a unified package. And I would wish to dispute anybody who said that it was a unified package. Teaching is what teachers do. However you might define teaching, teaching is what teachers do. But learning is what the student or the pupil or the learner does. And it was it was words from the cognitive psychologist Herbert Simon that influenced me powerfully from quite long ago when I was studying artificial intelligence. And he said, learning results from what the student does and thinks, and only from what the student does and thinks. And that stayed with me as being very powerful information. The teacher, he says, can advance learning only by influencing what the student does to learn. And for reasons that will become obvious later on, that's become a very powerful idea in everything that I've then written and thought about. And interestingly, and I was really quite surprised recently in the literature to read an article by a fairly erudite scholar who wrote about instructional disobedience. And he was talking about the incidence that there is, particularly in higher education, of students who, I can find no other way to say it, but actually sabotage the learning opportunities that are made available to them. In other words, no matter what learning activities that might be introduced to them, the students decide for whatever reason that they're not going to attend to these learning opportunities. And I mean, the consequence of that is, of course, that if you don't attend to these opportunities, you are denying yourself the opportunity to learn. So that's a troubling idea in my view. And the third reason I want to emphasize teaching is that it doesn't have a direct relationship with learning. It is intended to promote learning, but we all know how many interruptions that there can be, interferences that we hadn't planned for can happen. And so teaching as intended simply doesn't happen. So today I'm wanting to use Nathaniel Gage's definition of teaching, which is one person's influence aimed at improving the learning of another person. One person's influence aimed at improving the learning of another person. This can happen in a face-to-face way, or it can also happen when the teacher creates some sort of influential event which might be quite transformative. For example, being introduced to a particular painting or being engaged in reading a particular page or piece of text. Sometimes there you'll experience that catch-on feeling where you want to engage in more. So these are the ideas that interest me. And if I compare that with what was happening when I started my teaching career, teaching, particularly primary teaching, wasn't considered a contentious occupation. It was fairly mundane. You had a duty to impart knowledge to large groups of pupils. And this was perceived very often to take place in an atmosphere of fear and compliance. That's the memory that many people older than I am have of going to school. They were terrified, basically. But teaching, when I started teaching, it was a matter of giving clear, correct, and comprehensible information, passing on this knowledge in a clear, comprehensible, and correct way. And this knowledge could be procedural knowledge, or it could be factual knowledge. So that was what the teacher was assigned to do. The learner was expected to retain this information and might also at times be required to regurgitate it. Now, if the learner succeeded in this, well and good. And if the learner didn't do very well in this regurgitation process, so be it. Because it was assumed that ability or intelligence was innate and was normally distributed. In other words, some people had lots of it and some people had very little of it, and a mass of people in the middle had kind of an average of it. So that was the idea that was behind ability when I started to teach. And that was really what was required of the teacher, to present new information carefully, slowly, with lots of explanations, lots of examples, and perhaps most of all, lots of questions. Because as the teacher was delivering, he or she would be assessing the grasp of particular children or particular learners in their in how much they were grasping of it. So that essentially was how teaching took place. After the new material had been presented, then days, sometimes many days or even weeks could be spent on extensive practice using this new knowledge. And this was usually done with exercises carried out in solitary silence by individual people, so that the people got lots and lots of practice, and the teacher would meanwhile monitor how learners were getting on. And if the teacher judged that too many pupils hadn't grasped what this knowledge was, then the teacher would simply reteach. And beyond that, that was teaching. And when I started teaching, there was a curriculum of arithmetic, not maths, arithmetic, reading, a little history, geography, nature study, no science, nature study. And if one was lucky, you got some music and some physical education. But I seem to recall physical education wasn't mandatory. I mean, I remember teachers decreeing that to a class, well, you know, you didn't do X properly this morning, so there's no PE this afternoon. And nobody seemed to complain. I suppose the continuation of this method of teaching was partly because of the research that was taking place in the famous process product studies that took place between the 50s and the 70s. And this was a set of experiments in which teachers' behavior was being carefully looked at with regard to those learners who did very well in performing on standardized tests versus those teachers whose learners performed much less well. So having a standardized test score as an objective measure, the researchers then carefully observed what teachers did, studied the incidence and type of behavior that teachers were using. And overwhelmingly, they found that particular kinds of behavior could induce higher performance on the standardized tests. And similarly, different kinds of behavior might not engage learners to perform quite as well. However, the process product studies did fray at the edges a bit, so to speak, because it showed that you couldn't teach complex subjects. You couldn't teach any complex thinking by the process product method. I mean, when I'm talking about the teaching that I was being expected to carry out, it was the learner's retention of the knowledge that was at stake. There's no question, really, not much given to the idea that that learners might understand what they were learning. That was a new thing, and would be a new thing for quite some time to come, in my experience. So the process product studies kind of fell a bit into disrepute, but nevertheless, they are still important in the history of our teaching, and they do have something to say about how particular learners might be taught particular content in particular kinds of situations. And the current favouring of direct instruction or direct teaching as a teaching strategy stems from the process product studies. But at the time that I started teaching, we shouldn't forget that there was also another influence, an influence that didn't have too much leverage on teachers at the time. And that was the publication of the Primary Memorandum in 1965, which was laying out quite a different philosophy for children, that they should be treated as individual persons who had interests and particular needs of their own. So the memorandum was encouraging us as teachers to teach perhaps in groups or to teach even individually, depending on what seemed best in that classroom. The memorandum also encouraged activity and discovery and engagement and interesting things like that. But really, these ideas of encouragement had very, very little purchase in the Scottish classroom. Scottish teachers and Scottish education for many, many years was essentially a very conservative with a small C business. And the other idea was that Scotland also had a very powerful inspectorate and basically teaching was sanctioned as appropriate as long as you carried on in the ways that I've described. So that was the, if you like, the first notion that teaching was behaviour that for the delivery of knowledge, and there was nothing else to question about that. That was it. However, with time and with people asking questions, through a number of sources now historically documented, it was becoming very, very clear that the primary memorandum's aims weren't being realised and that learner performance wasn't actually keeping abreast of the needs of the wider community or indeed the world at large. And Scotland's performance was relatively poor. So more direction was decreed as being necessary to come from the centre. And for the first time, there was a given curriculum, so to speak, and it took legs in the form of Education 5 to 14, where there were distinct curriculum areas, which you know well, language, maths, expressive arts, and so on, and times given to spend on these curricular areas. And this was to try to bring some balance, a much lauded work, a word in 5 to 14, to the very heavy emphasis that Scottish teachers hitherto had on the basics, you know, the direct instruction and the basics. So teaching in 5 to 14 was now to be much more responsive to learners, to we were now being encouraged to motivate learners and to keep them interested. These were not ideas that had been dominant at the start of my teaching career, but they came to be. And on paper, it looked good, but what it meant for teachers was a huge amount of preparation, an inordinate amount of preparation that they'd never had to contend with before. They were now required to teach contextually so that using a theme or a topic that might last for a term or so, they were expected to include in that theme the mathematics that was needed, the language arts that were needed, the speaking, the listening, the talking, the writing, all of these skills were supposed to be introduced contextually and thereby giving the learners a more rounded experience. So the theory went anyhow. Teachers were now expected to take responsibility for sequencing teaching and learning in a progressive and cumulative way. And even now they were beginning to be expected to assess learners. And this was fairly new. This wasn't current practice. So already in the space of about 20 to 30 years, we've moved enormously to the position of teaching as probably quite a complex notion, because the idea that teachers might have interesting things to say was a novel idea, and it was exciting. Of course, teachers have something to say. But then what teachers think about how they're going to do their lesson isn't something that's available for us to observe without some help. And so what became a proxy for teaching was for teacher thinking was to determine what a teacher was intending to do before the lesson. What were the teacher's plans? What were the teacher's intentions? What did the teacher hope to achieve? What were the teacher's objectives? And then having taught that piece of material, there was then a post-teaching debriefing so that the teacher could then reflect on how did that teaching go? Did that work? Did that not work? Did it go as I expected it to be? And this more complete account of what teaching meant was actually very easy to document, at least at the beginning, because all you needed was an observer who could be a experienced teacher or a college tutor or what have you, a teacher who would actually do the business, and somebody else with a camera who would record the whole teaching sequence. And thousands of hours of film footage was produced in these studies, which showed us very, very clearly that for good and for once and for all, teaching could not be considered exclusively to be the imparting of knowledge to any other that might be around. Teaching was now recognized to be influenced in ways not yet fully understood, but could be tweaked and changed with other new ideas. And these other new ideas included things like scaffolding, accelerated learning, micro-teaching, differentiation, all these things that are still important, I have to say. I mean, the mastery teaching had this idea that you could teach anything to anybody, provided you had given the learner enough time and encouragement, and provided you disaggregated the whole into small enough bites for the learner to be able to integrate. But that became a politically very important idea as well, because it's that idea that's enshrined in Scottish law now that mainstream education is the default position. Before then, it was perfectly normal to have to be categorising people on very limited information and inadequate information about what kind of education they needed. And the other powerful political influence at that time was the Warnock Report. So teaching was definitely not going to go back the way. It was just going to become more confused, especially as these ideas of differentiation and scaffolding became kind of, through the rhetoric, they became embedded in the curriculum as ways to teach, as though you could always teach by differentiating, or you could always scaffold the learner's stuckness, so to speak. So that became slightly problematic in the understandings of teaching were perhaps being infused with information, with knowledge that was impossible to implement and perhaps highly contestable, and certainly not without their own difficulties. So we were moving, but moving in a way that we couldn't have expected. This wasn't a clean or tidy way. This was a very, very messy, messy way. So we had made some progress. And I would like just to make plain that I think some of these ideas about mastery learning and scaffolding and so on, I think they are important ideas. And indeed, the literature would say that they're important ideas. It's just that you can't think of them as being crude and simple teaching strategies. Teaching is more complex than that. And that was beginning to show when the 5 to 14 curriculum played out fully, and that the ideas that were being promoted simply didn't work. So 5 to 14 was recognised by the end of the last century to be coming to its natural end, and what we have in place now and what replaced 5 to 14 is the curriculum for excellence. So we're now really, we've now come to the end of the 20th century, and we're now in the 21st century. We're now at this new and maybe it's a better phase than the last phase, in the sense that we're beginning to make inroads into what teaching actually involves. But we know now, without any argument, there's no one single way to teach. There's no prescribed way in which teaching can be guaranteed to be successful, however you define success. Teachers are working in a context where political, philosophical, environmental, socioeconomic influences all play their part, and these inevitably have variations and will influence the extent that the teacher can do anything in the classroom. But teachers are engaged dynamically with learners. They're not parties that stand at the side. They're involved with the group, however big that group is. And to a certain extent, that is it's uncharted territory. It's to a sense that improvisation, that great feeling that you get when you've done something, perhaps that didn't do everything that you said in your plans, but you get that general buzz in the classroom that what you did actually clicked. Now that for me is what teaching is. I suppose it's in part an art. When you know that you've engaged the learners, that they're with you, and that's an experience that perhaps develops over time. I mean, if you're going to overly mitigate for every possible eventuality, that you'll end up doing dull and boring teaching, which neither engages you nor the learner. So we're in a much more exciting time now. And I think the other important factor to learn, to bear in mind, is that teachers are now much more engaged in career-long professional development, where you learn during the course of your career things that couldn't possibly have learned at an earlier point, because you didn't have the experience, you couldn't have grasped the difficulties that were actually there at that time. But now that teachers are much more involved in their own professional development, they of course are becoming much more knowledgeable as experienced teachers and have a view as to how teaching should take place. And you'll notice in the movement of teaching that if particular practices are promoted but aren't actually carried out by large groups of teachers who, almost without any discussion, simply set aside particular practices, they do that for very good reason, because we've got to respect that the teacher is the expert in the classroom. The teacher should know what is best for his or her learners. So teaching now requires us to be able to manage the workings of a classroom. Okay, you've got to be able to do the class management bit and to minimize the interruptions. You've got to do all of that kind of stuff. But teaching also now requires us to encourage social interaction, rich social interaction, because we know teaching is a social activity, and in many ways learning is a social activity as well. So we have to do things that will inculcate social interaction and enable people to form good relationships. Another requirement of us is to actually enable learners to improve their own learning. One of the ways in which we can improve learning is to make sure that our own knowledge, our own fundamental knowledge, is up to scratch, because substantive domain knowledge does influence the quality of teaching. And we've got to be good at explaining coherently and fully what we want children to be able to do. And we've got to be able to challenge learners so that we're not, so that we're making appropriate demand of them. Now, that's very difficult to achieve and it's difficult to understand, but we are making steps in that direction. And we also have an obligation, and I think we're probably doing this least well, and that's to, we do have an obligation as teachers to engage learners in their own learning so that they can self-regulate, so that they can think critically, so that they can think about their own thinking, and so that they can wittingly plan for their own learning. And if schools were making, if schools are doing a good job of moving learners along that line, then coming to university shouldn't be such a traumatic experience as some students report it to be when they come to university and find that the many things that were done for them during their time in primary and secondary schools are no longer done for them. So I think we are at an exciting time, but nevertheless, we are not at an easy time. We are at a time when there are loads of opportunities for each of us as teachers to contribute to what teaching can be. But remember, teachers are always working in a curriculum which has been constructed by a considerable number of stakeholders, and each of them has their own demands. We're working in contexts where resources are very varied, where teachers' thinking is very varied, and where the impact of research findings perhaps aren't getting to people. And we are also, as teachers, in this tumultuous climate, being held accountable for what teachers learn and for what learners learn. So teaching is now much more nuanced than it was when I started to teach. It makes many more demands on teachers, and it will always be thus. It's an internal cognitive event on the part of teachers, and learning is an internal cognitive event on the part of learners, and so is a hugely complex programme. So, but if you're just at the beginning of your journey, don't be worried or afraid that perhaps your self-efficacy or your self-agency or whatever other self you're supposed to demonstrate isn't quite there yet. It takes years and years and years of experience, and I can say that with confidence, having taught for 50 years, and I have to say I still love it when it goes well. And thank you for listening.
Well, thank you very much, Effie. I mean, I know we've only got a very short time for the talk, and I think one of the things that we have to do is have you back so that we can have a broader discussion, I think, of some of the ideas that you've presented. In the meantime, though, I do have a couple of questions that maybe I'd like you to elaborate upon. And in light of that last comment around the tumultuous climate that we're in and the accountability culture that teachers find themselves in, early on in the talk you used the word performance in relation to teachers and learners, and later on you referred to the danger of teaching perhaps being overly scripted at times. So maybe you could say a wee bit more about what place there is for improvisation or spontaneity in the classroom.
Well, to a certain extent, and it comes with your knowledge of the learners of the particular class or group of learners that you might have. I think that comes with the good working knowledge that you can hopefully develop with a class of learners. It may not always be that you can develop that with every class, but there will be some classes with whom you can develop a very warm and positive relationship, in which case, in which they're very clear as to the boundaries of what can and can't happen in the classroom. And they are clearly aware that if anything were to go badly wrong in terms of their behaviour, you would make sure that that didn't happen. When they feel secure in that way, I think the teacher can then be much more relaxed and allow the learners to lead in whatever way they wanted to. I remember teaching I was quite far on in my teaching experience when I had a group of primary ones, a wonderful group of primary ones who will probably now be in their mid-30s, if not in their 40s. And as five-year-olds, they were just such a brilliant group of children, and they were very tactile children. And I know all the rules say you don't encourage physical contact, but they spontaneously, if they were upset, they would just mountaineer up me and look for a cuddle. Or they would, towards the end of the day, I would be preparing them for going home. And then it only took, this developed with them over, it only took them a little while for one of them to initiate cuddle time. And they would all descend upon me sitting in this wee chair, and they all wanted a little cuddle. Now, I allowed that to happen because I had a good relationship with them. But in another class, it wouldn't have happened. So there's a sense in which I think to begin with, you've got to kind of share the measure of the kind of teacher you are, not through what you necessarily say, but through the routines you set up and through the expectations that you make clear you're going to have in the classroom. And you can be quite upfront about that, setting the tone, the ground rules. I mean, for me, there are only certain situations in which the learners and I can all talk simultaneously. But, you know, there are other ground rules for other kinds of situations. So I think it comes with knowledge of your class, really. I don't know how better to explain that. I don't know.
And that makes sense. And, you know, leaving aside cuddle time.
Yes, of course.
I'm just curious then how you would describe your style of teaching as a primary teacher and as a teacher in higher education, and what the similarities and the differences then might have been, because I know you certainly never cuddled me. But then, well, I was a colleague.
Context appropriate behaviour is all clear. I don't know. I think one of the fundamental things that always bothered me, maybe because my own experience of being taught as a child was actually quite hazardous and in some ways not very good. I think my own experience of being taught, and one that I certainly always wanted to avoid, I was really keen that learners would understand. That was, for me, understanding was so important. And I mean, I can illustrate this from my own experience. I was a Gaelic speaker by that was my first language. Mm-hmm. And nobody taught me any English before I went to school in deepest Lanarkshire, where they thought I was a deaf mute. And I couldn't speak any English. I knew that my first name was Effie. And that Effie was what that's all I knew myself as. And I remember being given a reading book. You know, a reading book for someone who doesn't even speak any English. I couldn't get what this was about. And my mother would go over this reading with me. She would rehearse it and I would rehearse back the words, and I hadn't a clue what this meant. And I still remember, what was it, Janet and John, or whatever I was reading, I still remember coming across a hyphenated word, and it said band on one line and age on the next line. And I didn't know what a bandage was. Mm-hmm. So that meant absolutely nothing. So our first few years of my life were spent in a total haze of confusion and misunderstanding. And I suppose then I realized that understanding was extremely important. So that would be my kind of philosophy. And I always wanted both my learners and my students, I always wanted them to understand. That was my,
And I think, I suppose you've touched on what I was going to ask you, really, because you talked about mastery learning and scaffolding and differentiation, and you stressed that they shouldn't be considered as unidimensional, and they build on, I think the words you used were complex ideas built on abstract thinking. Mm-hmm. Now, they're very clear experiences that you had as a child. And I don't doubt that that's influenced who you are as a teacher. So what complex ideas built on abstract thinking have most influenced your own practice as a teacher?
I suppose it was I qualified as a teacher in the way that many people of my time qualified, which was having done a 3-year diploma in primary education. And that was fine. I achieved that, and thousands of others did at the same time as I did. And I then went out to schools, and I found myself at one point in special education, and I came face to face with the realization that I didn't know how to help a particular child. I didn't know how to respond to children who were in such a distressed state. I didn't know what I could do. And I thought, this isn't good enough. I can't call myself a teacher and not be able to impact on these people. So I then decided that my college preparation had been intellectually insufficient. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I would then go to university. And I was going to go to Glasgow University. As things happened in my personal life, that didn't become possible. And I studied through the Open University and studied for a good number of years. Well, no, not all that many, actually. I think it was 4. And I did a degree in psychology. Mm-hmm. And that degree stimulated me and taught me much more about what was involved in learning, and thereby by default what must be better required in teaching. So I suppose it was my own education that stimulated me. And interestingly, I hadn't been considered a person who had any, if you like, put it, any brains at all. I was considered to be on the poorer side of the fence, so to speak. And there were no expectations that I would make any kind of strong career decisions. And so becoming a teacher was, as far as many people were concerned, you know, was more than I could possibly have dreamt of. But then I realized through my own learning that I was nowhere near ready to be a teacher. And of course, getting the degree prompted me to study for higher degrees thereafter. And that was a powerful idea that stuck with me, that it's what I do to help me that enables my learning. And these ideas that I talked about earlier on about the learner taking responsibility, they're not just words, they're really important ideas. They were for me. I don't know if that answers your question, Claire.
Yeah, I think it does. And I also think it feeds into ideas around how we might support our current students grapple with complex ideas as they progress into their teaching careers.
Well, I mean, I think it is a hugely important consideration. And I think it's perhaps the area in which we have been less effective, is positioning students so that they really do take responsibility and do recognize that teaching is very limited. Teaching does not do everything that the learners want. And I think that's an important piece of information that all learners should realize. You know, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So it's the same idea in teaching. You can present all sorts of wonderful ideas. But I mean, things like if the teacher says to the learners, now I want you to pre-see that piece of text into its whatever many central ideas. Now, you tell people to do that as a group. You say, there's an activity for you to do as a group. So the group then decides, well, we're not doing that. And so decides that either they'll key it into the Google and get some hashed version of what they keyed in, or they'll, as I experienced as a university teacher, they will simply designate one person one week, one person the next week. I used to be quite hot on asking students to write precis of what the session had been about, so that I could discern what they had learned. But since they chose not to engage, they shouldn't have been surprised that they didn't learn. So I think what we as a society are not good at is making plain to learners that they have a huge responsibility. And if they're going to bother investing in anybody's time or in anybody using anybody's money to further their own education, they are really duty bound to actually participate actively in it. And that's what activeness means, not running around doing 10 jobs at once, actively being engaged in the learning that is in the learning that emerges from the teaching that's presented. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're there with that yet, because we're still very, very much taking the blame for everything that goes wrong, when in fact we're doing a very, very good job. We shouldn't be complacent, but we are doing a very good job, and we really need the learners to help us move further forward.
So Effie, even after 50 years, you've still got so much to understand, you see. And I noticed that you didn't say you've got so much to learn. You said you've got so much to understand.
Learning's fine. I have no objection to learning, provided it is fundamentally based on understanding. And the idea that's gripping me now is it's been in the literature for a wee while, and there's quite a lot written about it, student engagement. Mm-hmm. But it's to do with so much more than just a piece of content to be rehearsed, regurgitated when required, or demonstrated in some sort of way. It's to do with how the learner, how the learners can move forward and take the initiative in their own learning, and really how flexible cognitively teachers have to be. And I see that in the review work that I do, reading many, many interesting articles coming from all sorts of perspectives. And I have to try and adjust my lens and think, how is this teacher thinking? How is this researcher thinking when they're writing this down? So that teacher, constant cognitive engagement is really why it never becomes boring for me.
And why it never becomes boring for us listening to you, Effie. So hopefully you'll agree to come back and join us at some other point. Maybe we could have a discussion with one or two other people at the same time.
I think that would be an excellent idea. And in my role now as Emeritus Professor, that is an obligement that's placed upon me, should I be wanted. And I would be more than happy to pass on the little of what I know. I wish you all well in your endeavour.
Thank you. And thank you very much, Effie. It's been a pleasure listening to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening in to our Strathclyde Education podcast series. We'll be back soon with another episode.